You're going to get two messages this morning, okay? Some of you have heard about this thing called the Commission, which happens to be a group of about 80 Christian organizations that have come together to work under one umbrella using all of their resources and all of their energies to accomplish a common strategy. Now think of what would happen in Wichita, Kansas, if all the churches came together under and used all of their energy and all of their resources to accomplish a common strategy in the city of Wichita, Kansas. Marvelous. Wouldn't it be marvelous? For the first time in history, as far as we know, 80 organizations have decided to lay down their distinctives and come together and do just that in what is known as the Commonwealth of Independent States, the former Soviet Union. It began in 1990 with the premiere showing of the Jesus film, which was dubbed in perfect lip sync into the Russian language, and it was shown in Moscow to their arts and academy, and by invitation only. There were 1,500 invitations sent out. When the Russian government found out that it was premiering, they took most of the tickets for themselves, not because they wanted to stop the showing, but because they wanted to see it first, and they had to reschedule the event the next day for the legitimate people that it was being shown to. From there, the Ministry of Education approached the Jesus film people and asked if it could be shown in the public schools throughout all of Russia. And they were, of course, very reluctant to do that, realizing that this was a tremendous opportunity. They began to show the Jesus film in the Russian schools. And then they were asked to develop curriculum, a course on Christian ethics and morality that would go along with the film. And at that point, Campus Crusade, or the Jesus film people, began to break down in terms of they did not have the resources to do all that was required. Bruce Wilkinson from Walk Through the Bible had made a recent trip to Russia and hooked up with Paul Eshelman, the director of the Jesus Film Project, and the two of them began to strategize. They met in Atlanta and included Dr. Paul Kinnell from the ACSI, the Association of Christian Schools International. And the three of them began to hammer out a strategy. 1 year ago this past January, about 18 months ago, in Chicago, Bruce Wilkinson, Paul Kinnell, and Paul Eshelman convened a meeting of 100 Christian leaders at the Moody Church. And they wanted to lay out this strategy that they had developed to see if there was any kind of a consensus amongst these Christian leaders and could we cooperate together in some kind of a venture into the former Soviet Union. At that meeting, toward the end of the meeting, a gentleman took the platform who was a church historian, and he said, "I need to remind you that in 1919, a similar group of Christian leaders from around America met in this same church with the same agenda. What could we do now that the revolution had taken place in the Soviet Union? What could we do for the cause of Christ and the kingdom work?" And he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, let's not miss this window of opportunity as we did in 1919 and the door closed for over 70 years. So at that meeting, about 35 Christian organizations came on board. The Navigators were not represented there. We were invited, but our leadership respectfully declined because we're in the process of a transition on how we make decisions in the Navigators. More of a plural leadership rather than an individual leadership. And so on April 2nd, Bruce Wilkinson came, and some of you know the Pink House over here. 24 of our national and international leadership met this past April, to meet with Bruce and to hear about this tremendous opportunity. And he began to lay out what God was doing and the doors that were open, and he asked that the Navigators come join in this cooperative venture. I happened to be one of the privileged 24 sitting in that meeting. I was the Glen Erie director at that time, totally engrossed in my job and liking it. And yet as I sat there, I realized that God was doing something unusual in my own heart. I went home that night and I told Nancy, she's always lived in fear, by the way, from the first day that I came to Christ, that I'd come home with tickets to Africa. And now tickets to Russia, that's a different deal, you know. So when I told her that night, I said, "Honey, I just can't believe what happened." And we heard this briefing from Bruce, and tomorrow morning we're going back, the 24 leaders without Bruce, to decide whether we're going to join this venture or not. And I feel like it's a sheet lowered down from heaven for the Navigators, that we are compelled to join this venture. And when we gathered the next morning, all 24 leaders unanimously agreed. I've been on the U.S. leadership team, or I had been at that point, for about 20 years. I have never seen a group of navigators make a decision of that magnitude in that short a time. You know, we're a really conservative organization. I mean, we move very, very slowly. And this was a remarkable, because our commitment was to recruit, personally, the navigators, to recruit, train, and send 2,000 one-year missionaries over the next 5 years. Now, we hadn't sent 2,000 in our cumulative history overseas. And we were committing to go out and to recruit 2,000 people. Now, I decided that I would not make my desires known on April 2nd when we met at the Pink House in terms of my interest in the project, but I knew that God was in it. And I committed myself to silence because I wanted God to do it if God was in it. I knew that it would be very difficult to move out of the Glen Erie job and to transition. So I just kept my mouth shut, and we were meeting again at the end of the month, the leadership team, to decide who would head up the project. And when I left for the meetings, it basically had been decided that somebody else was going to head up the project, and I just kind of committed it to the Lord. I still felt that there was some piece that God wanted me to play in it. When I got to the meetings, found out that the other fellow had declined, and that, and then in the course of the next 4 days, eight of the national leadership came to me and said, Bob, we think you ought to do this. And so the national leadership team asked Nancy and I to move into this on May the 2nd of last year, and we took a week or so to pray about it and to get our hearts involved in it. It is the most single, exciting missionary project in the world today. I mean, when you think of a block of countries that for over 70 years have not just been closed, but where communist, atheistic ideology has been taught. And now all of a sudden, all the walls are open. And the Ministry of Education in Russia, Romania, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, you name it, are saying, come and help us in our public schools to teach our children about Jesus. We have over in the office right now our in-country logistics man. He went out on the first team, and he and his wife got it on their hearts. They're from Oklahoma. They got it on their hearts to stay over there for the 5 years and to help us with all the in-country logistics. He told me about going down into the south, into Rostov, and meeting with a Cossack. And they were a government official down there. And as they were negotiating and trying to figure out whether the Cossacks were going to let us come and work in their public schools, because this is an ethnic group, and they're a little, found out that this guy is the chieftain of the whole area. They are heavily armed. They have said, we will never go back under Russian domination. We will fight to the death if it ever happens again. He said, but our children need to know about Jesus, and you may come and teach them. And I could tell you story after story after story. Now, don't exclude yourself because of your age. The average age of our people going out, we have 140 people that will leave in 3 weeks. We've already sent out about 35 or 40 previous to that. But the ones that go, the average age is 35.7 years old. We have a pastor and his wife going out on this August group that leave. They're 70 years old. Okay, we've got people out there now that are in their 60s and having a marvelous time. And these are not highly trained people. They're not even educators. They're people who love Jesus, who know how to share their faith, and who are excited about getting up aside another Russian and just sharing their lives. And we're seeing walls torn down that, well, I'll tell you what. You need to talk to this dear couple right here, up in the front. If you want to find out just a little glimpse of what's going on over there, they got a passion and a heart for it. They've got some slides. They've got some pictures. And we've just hired them as recruiters for the co-mission. But we're really excited about this, and it's a tremendous opportunity. As you know, the political situation there changes day by day. I don't know whether you know, but they just canceled all the currency that was printed prior to 1993. They just canceled it. I mean, the Russian government said that stuff's invalid. You can take your old stuff, some of it, to the bank and get it redeemed. And right now Yeltsin's fighting for his political life, which is not a new situation over there, but it's very tenuous. We have gone in, and we may be excluded from the law that is banning the Protestant mission groups from coming in. We think we may be excluded because we're there by invitation of the Russian educational government. And we're operating under an educational visa, not a missionary visa. So we're hopeful that the door will remain open. It's a number one prayer request that you could pray right now, because I've got 140 people that have raised $2.5 million ready to go in less than 3 weeks. And if that door closes, we're in big trouble. I mean, to redeploy all those people to the other 14 republics. I'm not so concerned about Russia closing, because I think there's a tremendous movement going on in Russia right now that will not quit. And there are 14 other republics that are pretty open. But I am concerned about taking 140 people and putting them on hold for a couple of weeks or three or a month or whatever until we can get the logistics done in the other republics and get them placed. So that gives you a little idea. Out on this table right here to the right, you'll see a little red brochure. If you're interested, and only take one if you're interested, but it says, "Guess who's going to Russia?" And it'll give you further information. If you're really interested and you want to explore it, you know, you couldn't be at a better place. My office is over in the main building over there. You can call myself at 576 or Ruth at 577. And we'd be delighted to meet with you and interact with you. If there's a large enough group, we'd even come over and do a kind of a Q&A and give you some information on that. You can organize that amongst yourselves if you're interested. Yeah, I did have a heart attack on the racquetball court. I'd just come back. I'd been back 3 days from Bulgaria. I'd have no history of heart disease in our family. I had no prior health problems. And I had gotten back on a Friday from Bulgaria, left on Saturday morning to go to Houston to speak in a church on Sunday, which is not the way to schedule yourself. Jogged on Sunday morning, went for about a mile, felt real good. The next morning I went out and I had a little burning in the chest here, went about a quarter of a mile, stopped, decided to walk home, that I was probably suffering from jet lag. Had the same experience the next day and thought, well, I'm just tired. I came back to Colorado Springs, and at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, I was talking with a gentleman about our transportation into the former Soviet Union. And I said, well, I have two choices now. I can either go to the racquetball court or I can go see the doctor. I just had a premonition that something was going on, and I decided to go to the racquetball court. And I played 5 games and came off the court, sat down in front of the registration desk, and just wept. I mean, my chest was just on fire. And they got me to the hospital. I'd had a complete blockage of the LAD, which is affectionately known by the surgeons as the Widowmaker, and they did a triple bypass around that. It's the worst experience of my life. I never, never want to go through that again. 4 days later, I walked out of the hospital and started a rehabilitation program, and I'm back up to, well, I'm doing more than I did before, so, but, you know, that doesn't really prevent the heart attack. And we don't know. I hadn't really thought about this until the other day, but when I took this job, we knew there was going to be a lot of enemy activity. And since there was only one artery blocked and had a minor block, I don't know how, you know, God enters into this and what he allows and what he doesn't allow, but we have the commission team, the other organizations. We could write a book on some of the hits that we've taken. Paul Eshelman's daughter, 18-year-old daughter, basically has lost the whole sole of her foot. And, you know, that skin can't be replaced. And she got hit by a bus in Hawaii. They were on vacation. And it put Paul out of the picture for a couple of months. And just time after time, there have been these kind of spiritual hits that we've taken. And I don't know. I don't get caught up in all that, but it is interesting. Okay. Some thoughts on prayer. Yeah. Oh, you want this one? Okay. The Bogues have instructed. You know that Jerry is considered. Have you announced that? Jerry is considering going to Russia. And you know, Jerry, I forgot to tell you, I get to place the teams that go. And there are a couple of spots up in the Arctic Circle. So you want to be real nice to Bob. I can show you on my map. They actually are in the Arctic Circle. Okay? So, yeah, it's not like Kansas in the summer, I'll tell you. In fact, there is no summer there. So, some thoughts on prayer, and that's basically what these are going to be. I'm going to ramble a little bit. I'd like to talk more broadly just about the whole devotional life. And you know, when you even use that term, the devotional life, our problem is that we assign time to it. And it shouldn't be that way. Our devotional life is our devotion to Christ. And it includes everything we do, think, and say. And so when we talk about our prayer life, I feel sometimes, again, we confine that to an activity, so many minutes a day or whatever. And that's, you know, that's good. That's how we build some discipline and those kinds of things. But I think we need to think of prayer. There's a bigger picture going on here. And that prayer is not just the specific words that we say and those kinds of things. It's the way that we live our whole lives. God has made us for Himself, and our souls are restless until they find their rest in Him. And this statement is as true today as it was when St. Augustine spoke it. That our souls are restless until they find their rest in Him. Now, if you are typical of the people that live out there, you are restless. We live in a restless environment, a restless society, and we are so busy. In fact, busyness has become a way of life, and we haven't even realized it. We're rushing off to this event, or we rush off to that event, or we create our own events, and busyness has just come in like a flood. And it has caused us to lose our sense of direction, and our souls are not at rest. For most of us, our souls are not at peace with God. Oh, I'm not talking here about salvation, but I'm talking about our devotional life, our devotion to Christ as we walk throughout that. I think one thing this heart attack has taught me, or one of the lessons I'm learning from this, is that, you know, there's a lot more to life than my vision and my mission and my activities. God is the most important thing in my life, and my family and my friends. And so I have a whole new appreciation of relationships. And I think that's where life is really lived, isn't it? It's at the relational level, and that's what life is all about. Our lives are terribly fragmented. We're so busy. If you have kids in the teenage years, junior high and above, or maybe even a little less than that now. I mean, basically, you put your chauffeur's cap on, and you're going from, you know, one soccer match to the baseball game to whatever, and life is really fragmented. How many times do you sit down as a family and have a family meal anymore? Now, I don't know about you, but that's few and far between. As we were raising our kids because of the activity level that we were involved in. And if we were honest with ourselves, we would confess to emptiness and that even our busyness is not satisfying. In fact, busyness may be moral laziness. It may be the inability to discipline ourselves and to make proper moral decisions. And so we're busy. But are we doing the things that God wants? Is it moral laziness? We just don't want to make the tough decisions. I remember being a hockey player. I wanted my boys to play hockey, and I remember we got them involved in the local program here. A good little program. You know, it was one game a week and one practice a week at a reasonable hour. And they wanted them to play on a traveling team. And our traveling team is about 4 to 5 days of activity, plus you travel all over the state. We said, no way. You know, as much as I would have loved for those boys to develop along those lines, we said, that is not worth the effort and the time, and that's not where we're going to focus. You know, there is more to life than sports, and more to life than our kids' sports program. They will not die if they don't, you know, play at the level that you played or aspire to those kinds of things. So moral laziness. See, we could have taken the easy way and said, yeah, let's go for it and we'll just pay the price and that kind of thing. Have to make some tough decisions. A friend of mine says that sloth in our generation may be described as busyness. Sloth in the Old Testament was defined as laziness, but sloth in our generation may be defined as busyness. And we've just replaced one bad thing with another bad thing. Okay, I think there are two primary keys in our devotional life or in our prayer life. And they're defined under two words, desire and discipline. Proverbs 13:4 says, "The soul of the sluggard desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent or the disciplined is made fat." Desire, see, even the sluggard has desire, but because he doesn't combine it with discipline, he remains needy. It's when you combine desire and discipline together that you get the desired result. Well, what's the problem? Let's talk for a moment about desire. And this was really helpful to me. Several years ago, I went up to Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia, and spent 2 weeks in a course on the contemplative life under Dr. Jim Houston. It's an area that I've been interested in. I thought I'm going to go do this because life is passing me by, and I want to find out a little bit more about the contemplative life. And he talked about desire, and I thought it was the most helpful thing in the world to me. You see, I've prayed for desire, to have a deeper hunger and more desire for God. But it's the wrong prayer. Because God has already placed the desire within us. Our problem is that desire has become encumbered. And it's become encumbered by our compulsive addictions, by our sinful practices, by our busyness, and by all these other things. And what we need to do, and that's the beauty of coming to a place like Glen Eyrie. It gives you a week, you can kind of catch your breath. You can sit out there. I saw a gentleman sitting out in the front porch with a cup of coffee, just really kicked back. In fact, I thought he was dead. But you could just tell. I mean, hey, this was not home. And see, the idea here is to analyze what's going on in our lives. Where are those compulsive behaviors? What are those addictions? What are those sinful practices that are killing our desire for God? And how do we strip those away? And to get really ruthless with ourselves and to begin to do some analysis. One of the things that I've gone through personally is growing up in the home of an alcoholic parent. In fact, in this book by Jim Houston, he says it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, for the children of alcoholics to develop the kind of devotional life that they really like to have. Because, see, what happens in the home of an alcoholic is that you learn to protect yourself and you close down relationally. And so what I find now is that I've gone so far in my relationship with God and my relationship with my kids and my wife, and I seem to have hit a roadblock. And now I'm digging back through all of that stuff to try and figure out, you know, how can I break through that relational barrier that's there? Well, one of the ways, of course, is just to acknowledge the fact that it's there, and I've never done that before. I've never acknowledged the fact that I grew up in a home that was relationally bankrupt. And therefore, I know my dad loves me, but my dad will be here in another week. My youngest son is getting married, last one out of the house. Yeah! And and I'm moving to the Arctic Circle with Jerry, in case they want to move back in. But, you know, I know that my dad loved me. And that was never a question. But we never communicated. We never had a relationship. We still don't have a relationship. You know, we love one another. But he never knew how to develop a relationship. And I'm in the process of learning. And so we got to dig back into some of that. And some of you come from broken homes. Some of you come from abused homes and all of that. And I'm not one of these that I don't think you need to go get yourself a shrink to get it all worked out. And if there is any shrinks here, please accept my apologies. But I really do believe that the Bible has the answers. And my friend Jim Houston says that basically what we've done is we're going out and we're trying to buy friendship when we go to a counselor. And what we really need is a friend. And start there. Now, you may have some deeper issues that you need to work through, and I acknowledge that. In fact, I'm in counseling right now. because there are some deeper issues that I just can't break through, and I need a little professional spin on those things to help me break through. But the more important thing is to find a friend that you can go deep with, that you can begin to probe those areas with. So this desire is really important, and we need to learn, if we're going to restore that desire, we've got to break through and figure out what are our compulsions and our addictions and what are those sinful patterns and behaviors that are keeping that desire locked up. The second thing is discipline. And of course, discipline is a tough thing for all of us, especially if you're a busy person. Because then you got to make some tough choices. The moral laziness is no longer acceptable, and you got to make tough choices. And I've heard them all. You know, people say to me, well, gee, I can't pray in the morning. I just don't have enough time in the morning. Well, do you have any more time in the afternoon or the evening? No. I mean, the thing is, you've got to apply discipline to your life. Now, I don't particularly care where you begin in your devotional life, your focus, whether it's morning, afternoon, or evening, or all three. But you certainly have to begin somewhere to discipline your life in small segments in order for that discipline to carry over. And you know, we don't need to use the analogy of athletics because you know what it is. But you start where you are and you begin to build. That's what discipline is all about. You start where you are and you begin to build. So here's some suggestions on building this discipline into your life. First of all, set a fixed time to meet with God every day. No time off on the weekends. Now, a fixed time. You may decide that, hey, I can do this, I'll start 30 minutes a day, Monday through Friday. And because the weekends are a little more busy and the family, I want to focus on, I'm only going to catch 15 minutes. That's okay. Start where you are. Because it'll grow. Okay, I guarantee you. If you start with 30 minutes a day and 15 minutes on the weekend, or even 15 minutes and 5 minutes on the weekend, I guarantee you it won't be enough time. Because what will happen out of that discipline, as you do that, week in and week out for several months, out of that discipline will grow desire. And you'll find, golly, I just don't have enough time. I'm going to have to extend this time. And you begin to see that whole thing. Have a plan. Some kind of a guide. You know, I'm not one of those that just can take my Bible, sit down and open it up and just have wonderful fellowship with God. I do that from time to time. But I'm more of a program person. I need a little help to get started. Now, these two books are really good helps to get started. This is called Time with God, and this is published by, you can take a look at it later. It's by Word. It's the New Century version of the New Testament. So it's easy reading. But the way this is set up, I really like this. This is Wednesday. Here's your by the way, it gets you through the New Testament in a year, so you're taking bite-sized pieces. It's set up topically. So you're reading a topic for the day. You have all your New Testament reading. Then you have some Old Testament readings. And then you have an insight. And the insight is by guys like Spurgeon and Oswald Chambers and those kind of guys. About 15 to 20 minutes every day. Absolutely fantastic. It focuses your thoughts and your attentions into bite-sized pieces. So, Time with God, New Century Bible, Word. Here's another one. This one is published by the Upper Room. It's called A Guide to Prayer. It is set up very, very similarly, but it also has, what happens here is that the topic lasts for a week. And then you have New Testament and Old Testament readings Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Very, very practical. Probably this is, if I were going to start, well, either one are really helpful. And if you're having some struggles in your devotional life and you want to get back on track in something that's a little bit systematic and yet gets your mind focused, I'd say these two tools are excellent. Richard Foster takes a lot of flack. Wow, does he ever take a lot of flack. And I don't know where you are on your thinking about Richard Foster, but I can tell you that the guy has got some things to say, and you can, you know, there are some things there you may not agree with. But his Celebration of Discipline and this book, I think, will go down as classics. This is his book on prayer. Absolutely fantastic. I'd say this is kind of, these things are for your beginning, lower, intermediate. You want to go to the expert slopes. You get into some stuff like this. This is very easy reading. But what you need to do is you need to read this and then apply each chapter throughout the week as you're going along. You don't read this like a novel. So those are excellent books. And then this is probably one of those classics too. This is called Transforming Friendship by Jim Houston. And this is a fellow that I studied the contemplative life under. This is produced by Lion. Any of these books, if they don't have them downstairs, they can order them for you and send them to you. So, very practical on this prayer life. Instead of fixed time, have a plan. Thirdly, make yourself accountable to someone. Probably not your mate. My wife does not like me to check on her devotional life. Oh, we share spiritually. But, you know, if I catch her slacking off and I say something, bad news. You know, we don't do that. You got to figure out, well, you know, I mean, obviously by the laughter, we all have a common problem. But seriously, you need to find a friend because, see, what we're talking here about is developing friendship with God. And there's an earthly model for that. And particularly for you men in the audience, most men do not have many, if any, real friends. We have many friendships, many acquaintances, relationships. And we would say these people are our friends. But they really are not when you turn in terms of really getting down to the nitty-gritty of life and sharing our struggles with lust and immorality and the struggles of life that we go through. And so that's why you find these pastors taking great headers and getting out of fellowship with God and getting into gross immorality. Why? Well, because they have many friends, but few real friendships. And men, it's a thing that we really need to work on. And so latch on to somebody that you would like to develop a friendship with. I mean, and really to go deep. See, I guard myself, and I found this to be a pattern in my own life, and it's a new discovery for me. I do tremendous in a group fellowship. I've led men's groups and mixed couples and so on for all of the years that I've been in the ministry since 1966. But you know what? It's been for protection. Because in a group, I don't need to get honest. And I don't need to share the real fear that I've lived with for all of my life, that you might not like me. And there may be some things in my life that you don't like, and therefore you reject me. So it's a lot easier to operate in a group context. And man-to-man has always been very, very difficult for me. Can you imagine that? A navigator that struggles in having a man-to-man relationship. But it's because you have to get down to the gut level. And that's what it's all about. There's an earthly model for our heavenly relationship. So make yourself accountable. Begin where you are. And then, let's see, oh yeah, right here. Fourthly, a journal. Absolutely indispensable. Now guys, again, most guys don't like to journal. But I'll tell you what, I mean, it only needs to be a few sentences, you know, just the date, a few sentences every day. What I do is I'm into one of these, or whatever guide I'm using in my devotional life, and then I take one thought, and I just begin to write. And that's the key. Just begin to write. Don't even think about it. Just begin to write what you're thinking about. And I've found sometimes I'll go on for two or three pages. Now, this is after I've developed this whole practice over the last 3 years. But I think a journal is absolutely indispensable if we're really serious about our prayer life and going deep with the Lord. There's a favorite book I have. It's called The Table of Inwardness. It was produced by Calvin Miller. It's an InterVarsity book. If you can lay your hands on it, I don't know whether it's out of print or not, but listen to a couple of these quotes. Carl Jung believed that the central neurosis of our time was the absence of inwardness. The absence of inwardness. Just taking time to analyze what's going on and developing that relationship with the Lord. From the same book, intimacy with Christ comes from entering His presence with inner peace rather than bursting into His presence from the hassles of life. I think that's why I begin my devotional life first thing in the morning. It's the calmest I'm going to be all day. And I can get a little more focused. Same book. The last barrier to full intimacy with the Savior is hurriedness. We're in a hurry. We're always in a hurry. And we need to overcome that. Inwardness is established by certain premeditative disciplines that clear away the debris and noise of life. You got to clear all that clutter away in order to focus. No individual's prayer life will be greater than the quality of his regular time set apart to meet with God alone. And out of Psalm 4, verse 2, in the NIV version, there's a little phrase. It says, "How long will you live with these delusions?" Let me articulate a few of the delusions that we live with. These are my own, okay? Not yours, but these are mine. That intimacy with Christ is easily developed. See, that's a delusion that we live with. I find that intimacy with Christ is the hardest work of my life. I mean, when you really think about it, and I guess having a near-death experience causes you to think about it. But when I came out of surgery, for the next 2 weeks, I lost my salvation. And God had disappeared. You talk about the dark night of the soul. I went through it. And I've determined that I'll never go through that again. Not by my effort physically, but because I am going to develop that intimacy with Christ that will not allow that to happen again. See, I had it all up here. And so when I went through that period of time, I mean, I had to go to the Word and start with righteousness. Whose is it? Who gives it? How do you get it? How do you keep it? All of those things started right back square one. And for 2 weeks I wrestled. And I wondered if I had died. I knew that I would not be with God. Now, that's an awful state to find yourself in. But I think it's because I was so activity oriented that I didn't really have the intimacy with Christ that allowed. And I know that heart surgery and a traumatic body experience like that, that there is depression that follows that. And all, you know, the doctors told me that, the nurses told me that, but that still doesn't, that didn't help. I mean, for them to tell you, well, it's normal, you're just going through, that's no help at all. I thought I was losing my mind. So, that intimacy with Christ is easily developed. That's a delusion. That life will be peaceful. That's a delusion. If you're looking for peace here on earth, not going to happen. Okay? It's not going to happen, folks. I mean, all you got to do is watch 30 minutes of news at night and you think, what in the world is happening? You know, we got a river that's pouring all over the place, and then you go to the southeast and they're looking for a drop of water. And then you look at Bosnia, a war that they can't stop. They can't even figure out who's fighting who and how are we going to sort that mess out. We go over to offer aid and resources to an African country, and now we end up shooting one another. And I mean, where's it all coming to? And Russia canceled. Imagine, cancel your currency. Imagine that happening in the U.S. Huh? I mean, you see these women, these Russian babushkas on television, and they got, you know, 60,000 rubles, their entire life saving, $60. And it just got wiped out. I mean, think about it. Life, it's a delusion to think that life will be peaceful. We can be at peace, but life will not be peaceful. Here's another delusion that many of us in this room live with, that money will solve my greatest need. If I just had a tad more, a little bit more. You know, I did a whole study on finance through the scripture last year. And the number one principle in finances is contentedness. To be content with what you have. Because you may not have any more. And you're fortunate to have what you have. Contentedness. Here's another delusion, that evil will not touch me. Too many gray hairs in this room for that one to get by. We know that evil does touch us. Here's one that we live with, a lot of us, that my partner will meet my greatest needs. That my life's partner will meet my greatest needs. My wife meets many, many needs in my life. And I meet many, many needs in her life. But we don't meet each other's greatest need. That can only be done by Christ. That physical rest, this is a delusion, that physical rest will restore my soul. You know, I'm one of those people that I'm very compulsive, very active. And I think, boy, if I could just get a couple of weeks off, you know, and just go rest somewhere, that'll restore my soul. If I don't have restoration of my soul going on a daily basis, I am in deep trouble. Because it's not going to happen. Those two-week vacations right now are a thing of the past. And life is just too active for me to do that. Another delusion, that life will not end for me. Boy, when you have a heart attack and they're carting you out to the hospital, they wheel in all that equipment. I mean, you think, oh, wait a minute, this is going a little too fast. Could this really be the end? I mean, I'm 54 years old. See, and I play racquetball at a competitive level, tournament level. And my racquetball partner, we're in the 50 to 55 age group, my racquetball partner died, 51 years old, died in October on the same racquetball court. Heart attack, just hit the floor. So all of that was going through my mind. I'll tell you what, it has reordered all the priorities in my life in a whole new way. Now let me end with one quote. It's a rather long one, so you just kind of kick back and listen to this, okay? And we'll end with this. This is a report by a writer who spent some time with Dr. Malik, who used to be the president of the Security Council of the United Nations. The greatest privilege and experience for me this past year was time spent with Dr. Charles Malik of Lebanon, former president of the United Nations General Assembly, president of the Security Council, and without question, one of the greatest Christian statesmen of this century. Dr. Malik, a founder of the United Nations and author of the Declaration of Human Rights, has held key leadership responsibilities during most major crises of the last 40 years. He was president of the Security Council during the Korean invasion and again during the Hungarian uprising, right up through the various crises in the Middle East. Most of October, November, and December was spent with him in various parts of the country. Wherever we were, with business leaders, government officials, community leaders, philanthropists, or taxi drivers, he figured out natural ways to graciously and effectively share Christ. We spent hours discussing the atmosphere in a crisis, the immense demands of a leader on a leader's time, the pressures from all sides, the growing threat and danger of nuclear war, the degeneration of Western civilization. And I asked, how in the midst of all of this chaos do you maintain your own sense of values and priorities, of what is right and wrong? How do you find meaningful solutions for the chaotic times in which we live? Pretty pertinent question, right? I'll never forget his answer. Going over to his still unpacked suitcase, he ever so carefully took out a book. The pages were loose, some fell out. It was beat up, worn, and looked terrible. Yet he handled it so carefully, and he carried it like it was the greatest of all treasures. As he sat down, I could tell that the beat-up old book was his Bible. I asked if I could hold it, and as I turned to page after page in the Old and New Testaments, there was hardly any room on any page for more writing. Every page was well-worn and obviously well-read and studied. I asked him how often he had to get a new Bible, thinking that the Bible on my lap was at least 20 years old. He replied, about every 2 years. At 70 years of age, wearing out a Bible every 2 years by studying it. I knew what his answer would be to my original question. He simply said, you must get to know the author of this book and put into practice everything he tells you to do. As a college student, he had established priorities, and down through the years, his first priority has been to begin each day alone with God and His Word, no exceptions permitted, ever. As we traveled and lived together, I saw that Dr. Melick never began his day with man and their problems until after he'd come out from the presence of God. No excuses. We live busy lives. Everybody's busy. But do we have the discipline and the desire to do what Dr. Melick has done? You can have devotional habit without having a devotional life. But you cannot have a devotional life without having devotional habit. And that's the whole message for this morning. If you've come here and you're a little bit wounded, a little bit beat up, and maybe some of the disciplines have begun to slip in your life, this is a good opportunity this week just to get out there in that grass or up in the mountain and make some new commitments, set some new priorities for your life. You can have devotional habit without having a devotional life, but you cannot have a devotional life without having devotional habit. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank you for Glen Eyrie and what it's meant to many of us down through the years. It's a place of refuge. It's a place where we can come and for whatever reason, we really sense your presence here. It takes us out of the hurriedness and the busyness of life. And when we drive through those gates, there's just something hallowed about the place. And we want to thank you for providing this for the Navigators many years ago in a miraculous way and how you've kept it in use. And many people have come here who have been broken and wounded and beat up. And they go back out through those gates, restored and refreshed and revived. And I pray that for the folks here in this room, Lord, the ones that have come, particularly the ones that have come, and life has just been brutal this last year. And perhaps the marriage is really on shaky ground, or the kids are in rebellion, or the business is not doing well, and all of these things that just seem to crumble around us. Lord, I pray for those that when they leave this grounds, not that their circumstances would be changed, but their hearts would be changed, and there'd be a fresh new sense of your presence in their hearts. We pray these things in the precious name of Jesus. Amen.